from KQED.
And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer. And for the rest of the hour, we're talking about nutritional supplements that makers say enhance memory and brain health, marketing them to Alzheimer's patients and their caregivers. Americans spend more than $3 billion a year on these supplements alone, and our guest this hour has been studying their effectiveness or lack thereof. Joining me is Joanna Helmuth, Assistant Professor of Neurology at UCSF's Memory and Aging Center. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, first, let me begin by just asking you about these supplements and, you know, what are the claims and how do they claim to work?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting topic that's I'm getting a lot of questions about in my clinic. You know, supplements are regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, and there's actually very limited regulation of the claims that they can make. So they can make structure and function claims. They can say, you know, calcium improves bone strength. They can say things like this supplement can improve memory and cognition. But they don't actually have to prove that to the Food and Drug Administration in any way. And I think that it can create this very ambiguous area for a lot of consumers when they see these bold claims on bottles. And particularly for individuals who have concerns and are vulnerable. They're, you know, concerned about their thinking and memory. They're worried about Alzheimer's disease. And so I thought we thought it was very important to write this paper that came out in JAMA a few weeks ago to really inform individuals in society, as well as physicians, that, you know, the Food and Drug Administration doesn't have this strong regulation of supplements like people might think.
Yeah, and I guess that's been a longstanding issue, right? I mean,
certainly.
I think there have been certain members of Congress, I think Orrin Hatch, for example, is one of them, who has protected the vitamin and supplement industry from stronger regulations. Mm-hmm. And so what kind of, I mean, it's one thing for a supplement not to work, but then it could also be harmful, right?
Exactly. I mean, I think that, again, there's the safety and the efficacy side of this with the Food and Drug Administration. I think that what we worry about safety is that based on the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, you know, these supplement manufacturers do not need to prove the safety of these supplements to the FDA. Supplements are reflexively considered safe until proven otherwise. And so actually the FDA can't act until these supplements harm individuals. And I think that, you know, often we don't know exactly what's in them, how they interact with other people's other medications that they're taking or other medical conditions. So it can be a very challenging landscape.
And what are the substances actually? I mean, what are they made of?
That's a great question. I think it's often hard to know. You know, I've gone into, you know, and looked at on the shelves of some of these bottles and tried to look at some of the supplements. And it's often a little bit challenging to know what they are. You know, there's things like jellyfish proteins and, you know, different plant compounds. And when you look at the basic science papers that are supposedly supporting the efficacy of these, it's the data just aren't there to prove that they're effective.
And I'm wondering also who sponsors the research.
Exactly. Well, you know, I think that you know, something we talk about in the paper is that there's kind of this whole industry of predatory open access journals where they require that the authors, you know, pay a high fee, often thousands of dollars, to get their papers in. And they actually have very low editorial oversight. And so it's not hard to get a scientific-looking paper into a journal that may or may not have any quality to it.
And these are, we're talking about supplements and vitamins and minerals, whatever, but there are different rules that apply to pharmaceuticals, right?
Exactly. So the Food and Drug Administration actually has various rigid standards for prescription drugs. You know, you actually have to prove that a drug is safe for an individual before you can have it on the market. You actually need to prove that it's effective. So it's almost the entire opposite of safety and efficacy for supplements compared to prescription drugs.
And of course, unlike a lot of countries, if not most, we also allow these things to be advertised on television, whether they're pharmaceuticals or supplements, right?
Exactly. Again, you know, based on this act of Congress from 1994, these supplement manufacturers can make fairly broad claims legally without providing any evidence to the FDA. They can say, you know, this supplement improves your cognition and your brain health, and they don't have to provide any evidence to the FDA that that's true.
What would you say to, you know, a patient or a caregiver, a loved one who says, look, you know, we're desperate. You know, my grandmother is losing her memory, and what what could be wrong with trying something?
Certainly, certainly. And I think that it's a very valid point, because in a lot of situations, I'm working with patients with Alzheimer's disease, patients who are basically given a diagnosis that's very frightening. And, you know, at the current point in science, we don't have a cure for these diseases. So often there is this element of hope that's kind of put out there, and that, you know, what harm could it do? It's an extra $20, $50 a month. And I think one of the arguments that we make in the paper that came out a few weeks ago is that, you know, this is probably diverting resources to low efficacy interventions and away from high efficacy interventions. So when I'm sitting in clinic with patients and families, I often take the approach of, if you were my family member, what would I recommend? And I often say, you know what, there's a lot of great, inexpensive, if not free, interventions that we know can promote brain health. We know that what is good for the heart is good for the brain. And so we really promote cardiovascular exercise. 2.5 hours a week is what the American Heart Association recommends. A Mediterranean diet. Let's make sure your blood pressure is well controlled. Let's make sure you're not smoking. Let's make sure you're cognitively active. So it doesn't have to be any particular program. You don't have to pay for things, but do something that gets you engaged.
And puzzles,
you
know, even.
Exactly, exactly. Something that you enjoy doing. And then we also want people to remain very socially active. We know that social isolation and loneliness is not good for brain health, and that people do better cognitively when they're socially engaged. And these are all interventions that are really these lifestyle interventions. It's very broad and personalized. And at the same time, we're not really relying on the pharmaceutical industry either for brain health.
Talking with Joanna Helmuth. She is assistant professor of neurology at UCSF's Memory and Aging Center. And we're talking in particular about claims made by supplement makers about brain health, memory, and so on. If you want to give us a call, and if you have a question or comment, give us a ring at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. If you have a comment about your own experience or questions with these kinds of supplements, you can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Have you gotten any pushback from the industry since this paper came out?
I wouldn't say pushback from the industry. I've gotten both positive and negative comments from individuals that have been delivered to me personally. And I think a lot of the negative comments that are made are, one, concerned that our motivations are really wrapped up in the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, as I, you know, said before, the interventions I'm suggesting are really not based in pharmaceutical industry. They're really based in lifestyle changes. Things are largely free.
So they're saying what? That you're trying to push people toward drugs, basically?
Exactly. You know, my hand is in the pocket of Big Pharma. And, you know, I openly disclose that I have no disclosures and I have no relationships with big pharmaceutical industries in the paper that came out a few weeks ago. I think the other concern that people have is that, you know, that we're not open to taking a holistic approach to brain health. And the reality is I'm very open. And I would love to see studies that support the efficacy of these. I think the problem is that when you actually look at the primary papers themselves, they're of low quality, and they give this illusion that there's scientific support for them, but they're just not there. And I challenge them to do better studies and prove to us that they work, and then I'd love to adopt them.
What are the ethics of not only providing and promoting and marketing these things, but even recommending them if you're a provider?
Fair enough. You know, I think that it's a challenging landscape because, as you described earlier, there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of desire to do something. And I think that for some individuals, there can be a value in doing something. At the same time, I like to keep it very limited, and I like to have the scope be very understood, which is, this is experimental. We have no idea that it works, as opposed to the claims made on bottles where it will say this will improve your memory. You know, that is making a unethical claim, I would say. Unless there's data to support that, which we haven't seen that there is, they shouldn't be making those claims. So part of it is the motivation around this. But I would say in practice, I don't recommend any of these supplements to my patients.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go to the phones. Gary in San Jose, you're first. Welcome.
Thanks. My father died at 77, but before he died, he took ginkgo biloba, and he insisted on liquid rather than tablets, and seemed to help his memory. He seemed to actually remember things better, be more coherent, and I was wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah. You know, I think that the data for ginkgo biloba are not convincing enough for me to recommend them to my patients. I, of course, do not know your father nor his body. He knows that better than anyone else. And I can't claim to know whether that helped him or not. I think that what we try to advocate it for is supplements and interventions that aren't based on testimony. So individuals saying, I took this and it worked for me. We really like to see the broader scientific evidence that it actually requires a lot of rigor. And so, again, I'm not going to fault any individual or say that it didn't help them. I just want to know that the science underlying it is sound and very substantiated.
And Gary, what did you notice when your father was taking it?
Well, I noticed that he recalled things better that took place earlier in the day, or conversations that we had, or nouns. And he said, though, that don't get me the pills, get me the liquid. The liquid is what really works.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, there's also, the potential placebo effect, right, which is real.
Exactly. And there is some value to that. Again, I think that this notion of hope and placebo effect do have some value. I think the question is, do they take a higher value and should we devote our resources to that as opposed to these other interventions that we know are, supported by the evidence?
All right. Thanks very much, Gary. Let's go to Marissa now in Oakland. Welcome.
Hi there. Thank you for having me. You know, as I listen to this information, I'm concerned, and I feel that this is very much a neglected area, and that is around the toxicity of these supplements. You know, Orrin Hatch, the Republican from Utah, where many supplement companies are based, deregulated them for a nice check. The result has been, I think, disastrous for a lot of Americans. They have no idea. We have Prop 65 here in California, which requires citizen enforcers to basically sue the supplement companies when there's toxins. And many people are very shocked to find out that there's lead, heavy metals, mercury,
exactly,
things that I have found right on Whole Foods shelves that are contaminated, things like bentonite clay, various green foods that are known to have high levels of lead that cause birth defects and neurological issues with the public. Many consumers ignore the Prop 65 labels because they don't understand the gravity of it. They're very small and easy to read or difficult to read. And so there's just not enough attention placed on the contamination that these supplements have for whatever reason. You know, supplements from China, highly contaminated.
Right.
It seems to be something that's ignored.
Yeah.
I entirely agree. I'm just here shaking my head in agreement with you. Again, you know, these supplement manufacturers do not need to prove their safety to the FDA. And so we really do not know what's in them.
You know, there are plenty of organizations that are supposed to be protecting consumers. I mean, have there been any efforts to sue any of these manufacturers or to go to a company like, you know, Whole Foods and say, you know, point out what Marissa is saying here, that there's some things on your shelf that are harmful.
Well, you know, I can speak to what I know, which is that there is a supplement that I'm asked about often. And the FTC sued this company for fraud in recent years, saying that, you know, you're making claims that are unsubstantiated. And this company had a large legal backing, apparently. And, and that case is eventually dropped.
Does go ahead. Sorry.
No. Go ahead.
Well, do these sort of loose regulations make it harder to sue a company?
Exactly. Well, I mean, I think that it's a challenging situation because one, there's loose regulations, and two, the FDA, my understanding is, does not have a broad body of individuals who can actually investigate these claims. You know, from what I read, I think that we have as many neurologists at the UCSF Memory and Aging Center as they have individuals at the FDA really trying to regulate these supplements. And and that's on a national scale.
All right, Marissa, thanks very much for the call. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. And Anthony in San Jose, you're next. Welcome.
Thank you. My question is not about pills as supplements, but a treatment called hyperbaric treatment, where you put a person inside a vessel with high-pressure air. And it started to be used, in the early part of the 20th century for divers who got the bends. And now it's being promoted as a treatment for concussions and even possibly Alzheimer's treatment. I'm just wondering whether the doctor has any knowledge of use of hyperbaric chambers as treatments for Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, I certainly don't know the primary literature on hyperbaric oxygen treatment for dementia, specifically Alzheimer's disease. I can tell you that if there were data out there that it worked, that all the neurologists I know would be using it. Because the reality is we're as desperate as you are to find cures and really effective treatments for these disorders. I think that we would jump on anything with very legitimate evidence to prove that it works.
All right, Anthony, thanks for that. Let's go now to San Francisco. And Colleen, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Very interesting conversation. I'd just like to make the case that although I think more scrutiny is definitely apropos for supplements, no one wants to take snake venom and mouse hair, some shady supplement. However, I think it's really important to look at what's going on with pharmaceutical drugs in comparison. You know, there are lots of things that have been approved by the FDA that have lists of contraindications that are staggering, and also the multiple prescriptions that doctors hand out to patients. I know one person that ended up on 16 different medications and completely lost her mind. You know, and once those things were removed from her, she is now functioning very well. So I think, you know, there needs to be scrutiny on both sides of the aisle. And I think probably one of the worst things that can happen to a person in terms of brain health is isolation.
Agreed.
You know, your guest, you know, suggested that also. I think that is something that can bring somebody down into a complete malaise and inert. And so I think that there's a whole spectrum of things that need to be considered. But I wouldn't demonize supplements without casting a really harsh light on the kind of rampant prescription.
Let's give her a chance to respond. Yeah,
no,
good point.
And I think that our focus on supplements in this discussion does not negate the issue that there are a lot of medications that are overprescribed. You know, I feel like I'm fortunate that I work in a field that there are only a few prescription medications that I write for, and they're all generics. But, you know, one of the things that I do whenever I see a new patient in my clinic at the Memory and Aging Center is that I look through their list of medications and I say, what do you actually need and what is superfluous? What is actually making your memory worse? I think you're right that once you're on 16 medications, it's really hard to know how all of those compounds interact with one another. And many times, you know, this polypharmacy situation can make it worse. So I agree with you that there are issues within the allopathic field of medicine within itself doesn't negate that there's also issues within the supplement industry.
Colleen, thanks for the call. Although one other aspect of supplements could be that they can undermine the effectiveness of drugs that do work, right?
Exactly. Again, as I mentioned before, we don't really know how these compounds interact, so we're not exactly sure what's in them. You know, that we don't have to test them to know that what they say is on the label is actually there.
We've got some listener comments here. Susan asks, what about fish oil, lecithin, or probiotics?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I think that, you know, these kind of fall within the supplement realm. I think that we don't know that any of them improve brain health or can prevent cognitive decline or dementia. You know, eating fish oils is particularly great if you have a Mediterranean diet and you're actually eating the fish as opposed to taking the pill.
And you don't know where the fish is coming from, right? And those, where the fish oil is coming
exactly.
from.
Exactly. You know, as far as probiotics, there was an interesting paper that came out recently that suggested that not all individuals are affected the same way by probiotics, and some people can have these beneficial effects, and some people don't get the beneficial effects. So again, we don't really know the efficacy.
Here's another comment. Heather writes, can you speak to diet and brain health, particularly a high-fat diet being mm-hmm. neuroprotective? What is the science behind that?
That's a great question that I don't know that I know all of the primary scientific literature to speak to. I think that, again, as I mentioned before, what is good for the heart is good for the brain. And so we think about cardiovascular health. As a neurologist, I think about cerebrovascular health. So I'm actually talking about low-fat diet. I'm trying to get you to minimize your red meats. I'm trying to get you to maximize the fruits and vegetables that you're eating. We really want to protect all those blood vessels going to the brain because we know that the health of the cerebrovasculature is really important in these neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And Elizabeth in San Rafael, you're on next.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Hi. So I recently was diagnosed with the early stages of dry macular degeneration in my eyes, and the doctor recommended that I start taking a supplement to slow down the development of the macular degeneration. And I'm typically not really a supplement taker. I'm really careful about what I put in my body, and I'm just curious if you've heard of it or know anything about it.
Yeah. I'm not an ophthalmologist, so I can't speak to the specifics of that. You know, I think that something that's encouraging is it sounds like your physician is recommending this. And there are situations that I, as a neurologist, do recommend supplements for individuals, particularly if I know a patient has vitamin B12 deficiency. We know that that's very important for the health of neurons and nerves in the body. And if you have low B12, I think that's important to supplement or figure out why your B12 levels are low. So, you know, I can't speak to the specifics, but it sounds like, you know, this is something that's been recommended by your doctor, and it's probably, there's probably some validity to that.
We've got actually a listener, Rick, who also has a question about B vitamins. He writes, mm-hmm. I've heard the brain doesn't absorb B vitamins as well as we age. Is that a reason to supplement? I've heard especially that's true regarding B12, he says.
Well, you know, again, I think with vitamin deficiencies, we want to actually test and see that you're having a vitamin deficiency in your body before we give a supplement.
And those are pretty rare, aren't they?
Well, you know, it happens. You know, for vitamin B12, we like people to be in the low, not just in the low normal range, but in the, you know, high, in the normal range. So we like a B12 level to be 400 or above. So it's not uncommon that people are in the normal range, but they're in the low normal range. We like to boost them up a little bit.
All right, let's go now to Berkeley. And Mia, you're next.
Hi, thanks for having me. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Hi, thanks. I think another caller alluded to this earlier, but supplements are, there are so many different brands, and I think instead of just focusing on the negative aspect of supplements, it's important to realize that there are brands and manufacturers that use third-party testing to test the quality and the quality and the quantity of the ingredients that they're saying is in there. And I think it's, of course, I think diet is key, but it's also important to work with a functional medicine practitioner so you're not overdoing it on any one supplement. And then they can be really powerful. So I think that's really important to acknowledge instead of just focusing on supplements are bad, which seems to be the underlying theme of
yeah.
the conversation.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point, and I think that they're not all created equally is what she's saying.
Agreed, and I don't want the message to come across being that supplements are bad. I want them to be safe, and I want people to take them because we know they're effective. And so while we can have third-party providers who can test for safety, does that really show that they're effective for the claims that are being made? And so, you know, again, if these supplement manufacturers can show their efficacy, I'm all behind it.
Are there any brands that you would either recommend or stay away from based on what you know?
You know, I have kind of had a policy of not pointing fingers individually at any specific supplement
or is there
company.
A place you can go to where there would be independent evaluation of those things?
Well, you know, I would ask individuals to talk with their doctor. If they feel like they want to take a supplement or have an indication for, have that be an informed conversation that you can have with your provider. And I think that collectively you can often make the best decision together.
All right. Let's go now to Alan in Berkeley. You're next.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a physician, and I've had a lot of experience with natural product, having discovered something many years ago as a remedy for a side effect of a pharmaceutical. And I could spend a lot of time, but my key concern is that in demonstrating efficacy, you need to have money. And big pharma can demonstrate with billions of dollars, but say an individual practitioner or even an over-the-counter product company doesn't have that kind of money. And even if they do demonstrate some efficacy, they can't make a proprietary patent on Mother Nature. So, you know, in other words, the competition will immediately jump in and take advantage of somebody else's discovery. For me, my observation in my clinical practice was by serendipity, and I saw 6 out of 6 patients respond. They were having an adverse effect. I won't go into the details. And it was a
Yeah. Discovered.
Yeah. Joanna?
Yeah, you know, I think that it is not a fair landscape out there for some of these issues that you're bringing up. And, you know, I think that often one of the best approaches is to try to work with other providers to collectively, you know, get the patients together so that you can write case series on these so that then you can actually do controlled studies where you're actually testing hypotheses about what's going on.
All right, let's look at some listener comments here. One big problem, a listener writes, a temporary but real improvement in mental function and in mood is extremely easy to produce using stimulants, especially caffeine. Unfortunately, the dosage has to be near constantly increased to produce the same effects.
Yeah, you know, again, I think that there's a lot of things that we can encounter in our day-to-day life that can cause fluctuations in our thinking and memory. And I think the question is really, are these impacting things like Alzheimer's disease on a biological level of what's happening in the brain? Caffeine is really a symptomatic thing that temporarily can help. But
I was feeling that last hour. I had a three-shot cappuccino. I was like, whoa, I'm really smart.
I know. And my, you know, myself included with a cup of coffee before I came in here. But the reality is that a long-term solution? Probably
exactly.
Not.
Yeah. All right. Steve writes, seems like the FDA could supplement a tiered approach to labeling supplements. If no testing has been done, the label would indicate that. If safety testing is done, the label could indicate that it had been done and shown to be safe, but not necessarily effective. Finally, the top tier would be a label indicating both safety and efficacy. Good suggestions. I would have guessed that there's going to be some pushback and opposition from the supplement industry and their supporters in Congress.
Well, you know, it was interesting. A few weeks after our paper came out in JAMA, the FDA actually came out. And we don't know if it was in response to our article or not, but they said that, you know, not only were they going to target some Alzheimer's manufacturers, supplement manufacturers individually who were illegally promoting these claims, that they also were going to relook at the way the FDA approaches supplements in general.
All right. Well, and I should point out that we do have a link on our website, kqed.org/forum, to the paper that you co-wrote or wrote.
So I'm first author, but I have two other authors at the Memory and Aging Center that are a part of that as well.
All right, good. So there'll be some good information there. Folks can check that out. Joanna Helmuth, Assistant Professor of Neurology at the UCSF Memory and Aging Center. Thanks so much for coming in. We had a lot of interest, some calls we couldn't get to. I apologize for that, but thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to you for listening and for all your comments and questions the past 2 hours. I'm Scott Schaefer here for Mina Kim, and Michael Krasny will be here on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.